Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
In the decade or so that Annie Clark has been performing as St. Vincent, her songs have always been these lush, layered creations.
Just like an amnesiac trying to get my senses back. Laughing with a mouth of blood from a little spill I took.
And with her newest album, Mass Seduction, the songs have gotten somehow both more personal and more universal. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In person, Clark comes across as a little bit shy. She wore dark sunglasses throughout the interview, and incredibly intelligent. She has an encyclopedic familiarity with great musicians, both the famous and the brilliant but obscure. And she's an artistic polymath. Not only is she a critical darling for her songwriting and extraordinary skill on the guitar, her next project will have her directing a modern-day version of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray with a woman cast in the leading role. Here's our conversation, recorded over the weekend when Clark was in town with her Fear the Future tour. Annie, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me. I'm such a big fan of the show.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so nice to hear.
Yeah.
Well, you're a Texan.
I'm a Dallas Texan, in
That's
fact.
That's right.
Yep.
You seem like a kid who was eager to get out of Texas.
I wanted to see the world. I did want to see the world. So, I mean, when I was 18, I guess I left to go to school in Boston, and then I moved to New York and moved back to Texas for a little while in there. And, yeah, I mean, it's still the place that I most consider home, if that's any consolation.
Do you think people in those other places understand Texas differently than what Texas actually is?
I think that they don't understand what Texas is, because if you haven't been here, I think there are a lot of assumptions about Texas that are wildly off base.
Like what?
Oh, all the things, all the kind of like, I'll just say that there's an open-heartedness here and a down-to-earth, like a real
humility is probably not the right word, but
There's a warmth, there's a humility, and you know, people put a real premium on being down-to-earth here that I think certainly doesn't exist everywhere. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in New York and Los Angeles, and you know, that's not always the case.
Both of those places now are made up of people who very often have come from somewhere else because they're looking for what New York or Los Angeles is. Is there a sense when you're there that everybody's performing a little bit?
Oh, I don't know about that. I think in some ways New York especially is a great example of the American experiment, because you have all kinds of people living together in more or less peace and harmony, every single kind of person in the world, you know, in that one place, in one tiny place.
The song New York on the new album is so melancholy and beautiful.
New York is in New York without you, love. So far in a few blocks to be so low.
And it feels, in some ways, like a love letter to someone you've lost.
Well, I think that when you're walking around the streets of New York, I have a little apartment in the East Village that I'm sometimes at. But I think when you're walking around the streets of, for me specifically, the East Village, you're not just walking among the people who currently exist and you're passing on the street, you're walking among like all the ghosts of all your heroes. I mean, if you think of specifically like downtown New York scene, you know, you're like walking around Arthur Russell and, you know, Lou Reed and Laurie Anderson and Patti Smith and James Baldwin. I mean, you know, it's like it's the kind of pantheon of great, you know, 20th century American artists. So it's a love letter to the people who I have known personally who've moved away from the city, you know, dear friends, but it's also like just a love letter to New York and all the ghosts who now walk the streets.
I really love the meter of a line that has a very problematic word in it for public radio, but it just sounds...
I don't know what line you're talking about, Chris.
And if I call you from First Avenue, we're the only mother in the city who can handle me.
It just like the just the sounds of the words as they sort of beat out in that line are so great. And I wonder if you're just drawn sometimes to the way that things just sound in the ear before you even put music to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think of I like the challenge of taking a word with one assumed meaning and recontextualizing it and using it in a different way. So I'm using some rather blue language to say something actually really sweet, you know?
Yeah.
Just, you're the only person in the whole wide world who could, you know, talk me off this ledge right now. There's 8 million people in this city, but there's only one person who can say the right thing to me at this right time to make me feel better.
You are often described as a musician who should also be described as a performance artist. Do you agree with that?
It's an interesting thing. I mean, I think that my shows have gotten increasingly theatrical over the years, because I am such a big fan of, you know, people like Robert Wilson, or obviously touring with David Byrne was massively influential. And I think about performance. I think about the arc of a show. I think about, you know, what's the narrative and what's the thread that people are going to follow and how's it going to unfold. And but when I think of performance artists, for some reason, when I think of performance artists, I think of like someone taking raw steak and like beating themselves on the chest with it while screaming, "I want my mommy." So I like it's hard exactly to throw myself in the lot with performance artists because it. I feel like performance art gets kind of a bad rap. Like
it's not usually described as really good, right?
No, yeah. People when people say performance art, for the most part, what they mean is watching a performance that they A, did not like, and B, did not understand, and C, maybe there was nothing to understand about the performance. So it's not really it's not the biggest compliment when I think about the term performance art. But there is wonderful performance art. I don't mean to throw performance art under the bus. It's just that I think that's typically what people mean when they say performance art.
Preparing for this interview, I read a lot more music criticism than is typical for my show prep. And it occurred to me what a challenge it is to write well about music. And I don't know if you read music criticism about anyone's work, but...
No.
You don't.
I don't. Because, I mean, with all due respect, like, I've dedicated most of my life to loving music and listening to music. And so it's not going to make me enjoy something more or less hearing someone who doesn't play music's idea of what it is or should be. I feel like I have enough of, again, like context and appreciation and knowledge and all that stuff to be able to just know what I like and not have to be told that what I like is valid or why I should like something or why I shouldn't.
At what point in the process of writing lyrics and music do you start to think about the visuals that might accompany a song?
It's really symbiotic, this process. It's this record, Mass Seduction, is the theme of it, the theme of the visual, the theme of the kind of character was like dominatrix at a mental institution. And that meant like really bold fluorescent colors, the kind of stuff that, you know, Sex Pistols, Nevermind the Bollocks kind of colors that are like they look really cheery, but also if you look at them long enough, they're very aggressive and kind of irreverent.
Something's just a little bit off.
It's just a little bit off, yeah. And kind of silly. And two, I think I was kind of pushing the sexuality part to the point where it was just like absolutely stupid, like just absurd, like whatever that line of sexy and stupid is. That's where I was hoping to live.
I'm really curious about how you hire the team that will work with you on fulfilling that visual part of the equation. Like, you can see someone else's work and think it's really great when they've done something for another artist, but it's not exactly what you want.
It's always collaboration. I think the best thing, I guess the best skill in being an artist is knowing who to collaborate with. I mean, if you look at somebody, you know, people talk about Bowie very rightfully in hushed tones, and part of the reason is because he was never afraid to pull in people from every single discipline or people seemingly from left field into his music and his creative life. So I worked with a creative director named Willow Perrone, who I worked with on the last record, and the theme of the last record visually was like near future cult leader, which was, you know, it was colder. It was more austere. It was very influenced by the Memphis, you know, Italian design of the 80s. This one was like, basically what you do is you just put together like a reference images after reference images. So I pulled in a costume designer for the tour who I, when I directed a short horror film, I worked with her. And so I was like, I already had a good vernacular, you know, we had a little bit of a shorthand and a rapport. So I got her involved in designing the tour costumes, and had this kind of, again, this visual Bible of just reference after reference of colors from stuff like Guy Bourdin, the photographer, who's, again, sexy, but like ridiculous too. And I brought in my friend Carrie Brownstein to help write some of the promos because I just wanted it to have a different, just be sort of more lighthearted, and we live in insane times, so just kind of go like, let's push that insanity to the nth degree. And I brought in the DP who I worked with on my horror film to shoot the promos and shoot a video. So it's just, when you do enough things, luckily you just sort of have like a Rolodex of people who are like, you, and it's a little bit, I guess, like cooking, where you just have a sense that these ingredients will taste good together, but you're not entirely sure what you're making. But, you know, put it in a crock pot for long enough and
it'll soften up.
Soften up. Something will happen.
My guest today is Annie Clark, who performs under the name Saint Vincent. When we return to the conversation, we'll talk about how she developed her own voice by trying to replicate her musical heroes.
I would just be a teenager and try to sing along to Billie Holiday for hours, or like sing along to Nirvana and Pearl Jam. I mean, try to do Ella Fitzgerald licks, like follow, see if I could follow those. Newsflash, at 14, I couldn't.
That's after a short break.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking today with Annie Clark, the Dallas native who performs under the name St. Vincent. Clark has performed with a who's who of musical legends, from David Byrne to the surviving members of Nirvana when they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I'm so happy because today I found my friends. They're in my head. I'm so ugly. That's okay, cause so are you. We broke our mirrors Sunday morning. It's every day for all I care. And I'm not scared. Light my candles in the days, cause I found God. Yeah, yeah.
Let's return to the conversation when I asked her who she'd like to hear play her songs.
Oh God, anyone. The other day I watched sort of young country-ish singer on YouTube cover New York.
New York isn't New York without you, love. So far and a few blocks to be so loved.
And I'm so sorry I'm spacing on his name, but he was wonderful. You know, he was just like a kid on YouTube with a guitar. I'm psyched for anyone to try it. I think that's one of the things too, is like, you know that you've written a song that's sort of worthy or that speaks to people if other people can cover it and it still resonates. If people can do it in very different styles or in different voices and it still has emotional power.
As a kid, did you grow up listening to music on CDs, or are you...
Yeah.
Like, okay, so you had CDs where you listened from start to finish. That's not the way people engage with music anymore. So when you make an album, how much does it matter the order in which the songs are placed?
Oh, it deeply matters because, not in a sort of didactic purist way that's like, listen, kid. If you want to listen to this record, you're going to have to start at point A, get all the way to point Z. It's not that, because not everybody consumes music that way anymore at all. But plenty of people still do, so it should be a full experience. I mean, my record, the last chord on the record, is the first chord of the first song on the record. So it's meant to be a loop, essentially. You're meant to never stop listening to it, like a circle of purgatory. I wonder what you would have to do for that to be your punishment.
I don't know. What did you say? Insane asylum? Who's in the asylum?
Yeah, the dominatrix at the mental institution.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Do the songs become something else for you once they're out in the world and effectively finished in terms of having been produced for the album?
Two sides of that answer. One is that when I'm done with it, it's for everybody else, and I'm so glad that it exists, but it's sort of not for me anymore. Like, I'm happy to play it. It's it's not that, but for me, I'm always really interested in the next thing. So, I kind of go like, oh, this is, I love this body of work. I'm really proud of it. I put my heart and soul into it. But yeah, it's done. I could do it better the next time, or I'm going to do something different.
How did you decide what you wanted your voice to sound like as a performer?
A lot of trial and error. My God, I think, we're human beings. How we learn to speak is by listening to our parents, or how how we learn to sing is by imitation. So I definitely, would sit with my little kind of karaoke machine, like one of those big boombox kind of things, and I would just be a teenager and try to sing along to Billie Holiday for hours, or like sing along to Nirvana and Pearl Jam. I mean, try to do Ella Fitzgerald licks, like follow, see if I could follow those. Newsflash, at 14, I couldn't. But I mean, that's how you, it's just a bunch of trial and error. I mean, I think, you know, I learned to scream from singing live. You know, I would do a song that was like, that was a very kind of post-punky, kind of fast, kind of pseudo-industrial song called Crocodile, where I would, on a few tours back, I would jump into the crowd and like crowd surf. And I think I learned how to like truly scream.
Without hurting your voice?
Yeah, my voice is pretty sturdy. I haven't had tons of vocal lessons or anything like that, but I think the one rule for singers would just be like, if it hurts, don't do it. But other than that, you know, just be free. But yeah, I learned to scream probably stage diving and, you know, freaking out on stage and stuff like that. So again, just trial and error and different streams of emotion kind of come out at different times. And again, and it's also just a lot of, I think it was very helpful to be able to record myself from a very early age, because there's always, and it's applicable to every facet of life, obviously not just singing, but there's always this wide gulf between what you sound like and what you think you sound like. Or, you know, or like how you actually seem and how you think you seem. Like those, sometimes the gulf is catastrophically wide. And so the idea, I think, and I guess you could call this like the gulf self-awareness, but is to have the how you sound and how you think you sound be actually very married instead of wildly disparate, you know. But I don't know. It's funny, you know. You always hear like Jimi Hendrix hated the sound of his own voice, and everybody loves Jimi's voice, you know. But it's especially the vocal. You can learn how to get good at so many instruments, but your voice is just so the most personal thing, and I think takes a long time to kind of get accustomed to.
So I really like the song Pills, and it also makes me very uncomfortable because it makes me think of like teenage Judy Garland, right? When she was just a product and she was animated by all kinds of like pharmaceutical motivation. From healer to dealers and then back again, from guru to voodoo and voodoo to zen. Pills to wake, pills to sleep, pills, pills, pills every day of the week. Pills to walk, pills to think, pills, pills, pills for the family. Pills to grow, pills to shrink, pills, pills, pills.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that your reference point for it would just be Judy Garland on the uppers and the downers and everything the studio was giving her to keep her thin and keep her peppy, right? Because it was Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney, right? They were the kind of...
All the movies, they were making a show in the barn.
They were the kind of two child stars. I'm told by a podcast that Mickey Rooney actually had a way easier go of it, but poor Judy Garland, until The Wizard of Oz was kind of shuffled off like, oh, she's just one of our bit players and we have a million child stars. But anyway, Pills. Yes, it's a song that I wrote. I was having trouble sleeping and I took a sleeping pill. And as I took it, I was like, you know, I was just kind of struck by the like, really? This is one of the most basic human functions and I can't even do this without help. You know, it's like, ugh. And then I hummed a little tune. Pills do wake, pills do sleep, pills, pills, pills every day of the week. And I was like, you know what? That might be gold. I'm going to squirrel that one away. Because, I mean, a lot of times the songs that, you know, that resonate for me are like things that could absolutely be nursery rhymes, but the words are disturbing, You know, I think that's like one of the just one of the things that people, that's, you know, if you think of like the Jackson Five or something, all those are like songs that kids could sing or adults could sing. It's like really infectious like that. I didn't just compare Pills to Jackson Five, but just cut that part out. This is like, stop me talking.
You know, there are people who don't listen to the lyrics of songs, and I've never understood people who say X is my favorite artist, and then you want to talk about what the song means, and they say, well, I don't really listen to the words.
I know. I don't understand that either. Because, yeah, and you know what? And if it was the entire human population, I could save so much time, because I was always someone who listened to the words and immensely, like, you know, Jack Antonoff, who co-produced this record with me, we like made a blood pact that like we could write, make sure that the songs on this record could have lyrics that people would tattoo on their arms. Like that's the kind of like fervor I personally feel about lyrics. I mean, if I'd written Leonard Cohen's famous Blue Raincoat, I could like die tomorrow.
Oh, the last time we saw you, you looked so much older. Your famous blue raincoat was torn at the shoulder.
So I also don't understand when people don't listen to the words. But again, if it was everyone, I would save a lot of time.
How do you manage your energy differently when you were in the process of writing and recording and producing albums as compared with when you were, you know, undergoing this grind of performing on stage every night or two?
You know what? I keep it, it's pretty healthy. I work out a lot on the road because I really am like an athlete. It's the show I do is an hour and a half solo show.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a lot to ask people to say, hey, it's just me, be entertained for an hour and a half. So I put my back into it. So I do that. And this particular tour has been really sweet because I have my aunt and uncle, Tuck and Patty, as part of the show. They're opening the show. And the reason for that was that it's this like, they're so the genesis of my musical life and education. I mean, they were on the road when I was a kid and took me on the road with them when I was about 15, and I saw the world and I learned what it was really like to be a working touring musician. And you know, they played me John Coltrane for the first time, and in so many ways kind of gave me my ethos on music.
And excuse me for interrupting. For people who don't know, they're a jazz duo.
Yes, they are a jazz duo. They've been playing together for almost 40 years. They're a married couple. It's my mom's brother and his wife, and he is a virtuoso jazz guitar player, and my Aunt Patty is a virtuoso singer, and they're just brilliant. I mean, they bring people to tears every night. Like, and it's so wonderful to you know, be side stage for their show every night, and like from their first notes, people are hooting and hollering. How's that for a little Texas? They are legit like woo, like hooting and hollering. It's wonderful. So that part of that has been very sweet on this tour. It's very keeps me very sane. My little brother's my personal assistant, so it's like pretty cozy. And then as far as the other parts of working, I mean, the truth is it's that I'm probably just a pretty manic person, and I love to work and I love making things. And so it's either I'm an athlete on the road, or I'm working on a film or working on a record or producing someone's record or, you know, writing essays or something. You know, it's just, you can't really turn it off, and I wouldn't want to, so.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Tuck and Patty, I know, appear on a couple of tracks on this album, and I was curious if you asked them to do something very different than what they do on their own albums.
Well, you know, it was funny. I did want to kind of get them out of their comfort zone. I was like, what happens if Tuck plays electric guitar? Which was very cool. They're couple moments of that. But a funny thing was, there's a song on the record called Savior, which it didn't even sort of occur to me that it was like some extended, you know, BDSM metaphor for saving someone in a relationship, or, you know, it kind of, if you listen to the lyrics, it's like kind of sexy and dark. You press me in, a nun's black habit. Hail Mary pass, 'cause you know I'll grab it. Hand me your bags and a little penny club. Like I'm supposed to book you on a hit and run. And I had them play on that one. I had them, Patty, singing background vocals on the pre-chorus, and but someone asked me about that recently. They're like, was that uncomfortable in the studio when you had them play on that song? I was like, oh, it should have occurred to me and didn't. You know, a lot of things should have occurred to me and didn't. So
do you mind when other people make you uncomfortable?
Do I mind when other people make me feel no, because it's hard. It's hard to do.
Hard to make you uncomfortable.
It is, in a certain way. I mean, I remember an interviewer a while ago was like looking at my breasts, and I was like, where are you looking? What are you doing? Look up here, you know? And so, and I think that his intention was actually to make me feel uncomfortable, but I just was like, get out of my, stop. This is gross. Ask me questions or get out. But so you build up a certain kind of like, no, it's hard to make me feel uncomfortable. Because also, I wrote a record of all of my deepest thoughts and feelings. So I told you. So, what are you going to, you know, what's there to hide exactly?
My guest today is Annie Clark, who you might know better as Saint Vincent. When we return to the conversation, advice for aspiring performers.
Get really comfortable with humiliation. Get really comfortable with it, because in order to get good at something, you have to be really bad at it first. I spent a lot of years being really bad, really bad at a thing I love.
That's after a short break. I want all of your mind. Give me all of your mind. I want all of your mind. Give me all of that. Digital medicine. What's the point of even sleeping if I can't show it?
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking today with Annie Clark, the Dallas native who performs under the name Saint Vincent. Let's return to the conversation.
You mentioned Carrie Brownstein a little while ago. I really liked the tiny little series of video shorts that you did. Like, in lieu of interviews,
Yes. You
basically recorded all the things that people ask you over and over.
Yes. Well, so the original idea with this was that I was going to record a green screen interview where I would answer questions that likely people were going to ask earnestly.
If I had to pick one album to live with on a desert island, it would be... a flare gun, a first aid kit, a cell phone, and a boat.
So anyway, the idea was that I would be able to record this interview series and then earnestly send it off to press and be like, you know what, just put your own graphics behind it. It's on a green screen. Superimpose your interviewer into it, and then I can save a little bit of time. But as we got further into doing it, and Carrie and I started like collaborating on the writing of it and stuff, it just became totally silly and not at all it didn't serve the intended purpose, but it was very fun. And what it did actually was, it It scared a lot of interviewers from asking
those questions.
The more asinine questions, which, I mean, hey, I completely understand the dynamic and the quid pro quo or whatever it is in the earnestness actually that happens between artist and interviewer, and so it's not like I hate that process or resent that process at all, but it was pretty funny to kind of, at least nobody like asked me where the name St. Vincent comes from.
Oh, right.
Or like made me say it, you know? So just Wikipedia.
You tweeted once that work is more fun for you than fun, which seems like really great for an artist and sometimes hard for just living life as a human being.
Yeah. I think I have a pretty good system. I mean, I don't know. I love what I do. And also, when I really think about it, you know, everything in my whole life, every place I've been, every person I've met, for the most part, is because I got good at, like, moving my fingers on a piece of wood and steel. Like, that's crazy. Like, I've seen the whole damn world because of that. And so I just feel, like, lucky. Because also, it's an insane thing to think that you're going to do. Like, it takes an amount of self-delusion. And I encourage that self-delusion in every young musician. To think that you're going to go and write a thing that people are going to care about someday. Like, that's... But for whatever reason, I was so laser-focused on that being a reality, that, you know, I've gotten to just live a whole rich, rich life as a result of it. So, I mean, part of it for me is like, it's like thanking your lucky stars and also like paying respect to the thing that gave you your whole life. Like, it's a weird thing that happens too, because I think sometimes when people get very... way more successful than I am, like stratospherically successful, it's like they can lose track of the thing that got them there and kind of put the cart before the horse and think it's about like fancy vacations or something or whatever it is that the people like to do. So for me, it's just like, I love it. So why would I do anything else?
You have a line in Mass Seduction, and the song doesn't appear to be about this entirely, but it's, oh, what a bore to be so adored.
Yeah, you know what I was thinking about is there's a great Brian Eno record called Here Come the Warm Jets. And there's a bird that's like, oh, what a burden to be so relied on. And I just love that line. And so that was this, oh, what a bore to be so adored is sort of... I was like winking at Brian Eno, I think, when I wrote that.
Were you always a risk taker? Like, as a kid, were you a risk taker?
I mean, it really depends what you mean. I mean, no. Like, I don't like roller coaster, you know.
Like, socially, though, and putting yourself out there and trying things that other people wouldn't try?
I have no idea. I mean, I was with a bunch of high school friends yesterday because I played a show in Austin, and we were reminiscing and everything. And I think I was... I mean, they called me missing in action because I would be like alone in my room playing guitar and like putting up Robert Frost quotes or something on my, you know, just like so nerdy, instead of like going to the keg party. So I don't know. I don't know if I was much of a risk taker. I think it really just depends on what you mean. I was shy. I mean, I don't think anybody would be like, oh my God, yeah. Oh yeah. Annie Clark. Oh yeah. I remember from high school. She was the life of the party. Like, that wasn't probably the vibe, but it's hard to know, really.
I guess I just mean, as an artist, you have to have a certain kind of confidence that not everyone has, that you can expose yourself, even just expose what you thought was a good idea to the whole world?
Well, I've been doing these little Q&As before the show, and so I talk to, I mean, most of the people who come are artists of some form or fashion, and sometimes I get asked for advice, and I thought about it, and I was like, you know what, here's the best piece of advice I could give you. Get really comfortable with humiliation. Get really comfortable with it, because, you know, in order to get good at something, you have to be really bad at it first. I spent a lot of years being really bad, really bad at a thing I loved.
Did you know you were bad at the time?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I mean, of course I thought I was better than I was. Otherwise, I would have quit. You know, again, like, self-delusion is helpful. Comfort with humiliation. I just mean, like, have enough. I mean, I've played at pizza parlors for, you know, no one. I've driven 12 hours to play for literally just the bar staff. I've been booed off stages. I've been, like, you know, I've been, you know, I've slept on weird squat floors, and people have ferrets, and it's just, like, really gross, and you, like, use someone's random toothbrush, and you're just, like, disgusting. Like, you know, it's all the things that you just do as a touring musician, because you want to get up there and you play, and you want to get to that next gig, and you want to get to that next city or whatever it is. So I say get really comfortable with humiliation, because if you have enough of a remove from yourself and you can see it somewhat clearly, then you can laugh at it if it's bad, or if you can fix it. Because what I have to do with, say, these shows is I have to go back and look at the shows as if I'm not me and go, does this work? Is this working? Like, direct it in a sense, you know? Is that happening? Is that working? No, that's not working. Okay, change that. Da, 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 da. And in order to do that, if I was, like, so overcome with the shame of not succeeding or hitting the mark or whatever it is, then I wouldn't be able to make it better. So it's like, oof. You know, like, look, just be able to look at it somewhat objectively, because you has to improve somehow.
So the next thing you're doing after the Fear the Future tour is directing a movie, right? And this is Picture of Dorian Gray with a female protagonist.
Yes, set in modern times.
And, you know, I was thinking about the story, and it given the pressure put on women to be young and beautiful, it seems like it should have been a woman all along.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you're thinking about Oscar Wilde, who...
Poor Oscar Wilde.
I know. Poor Oscar Wilde. I mean, it's deeply, you know, sublimated queerness in all of his work, but I think especially in A Picture of Dorian Gray. And I think that the interesting thing, so in the world, female vanity is celebrated more or less, or expected.
Yeah, it's an obligation, right?
It's an obligation. You're meant to look good, quote unquote. And good is obviously a construct created by, what, patriarchy? Can we say that on NPR?
Yes, we can. Absolutely.
And male vanity, this is just me spitballing. I have no formal education. I've never taken a gender studies class, so just bear with me. But male vanity is oftentimes frowned upon because it's seen to be effeminate, mm-hmm. in a strict sort of boring patriarchal sense. That which is feminine is assumed to be weak or less than good, less than some male version of whatever. So male vanity versus female vanity, they look very different. And the how people view them is very different, and increasingly in these modern times. So it's a really interesting challenge to go, who is this person, and how do you contextualize her in a way that makes sense because vanity looks different on different people.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd.
How do you learn to direct a movie for the first time?
Okay, so here's the thing. And this might sound incredibly presumptuous, but you have to have an idea, you have to have a vision, and you have to assemble a team who is really competent and will help you execute the vision and help you in the areas that you don't know enough about and also trust you enough to follow you down the rabbit hole. And I've done that, not in film, but like I've done that.
I need to let you go in a moment here, but the last thing I want to talk to you about is I know a lot of people, myself included, who really love the song Teenage Talk from a few years ago.
Thank you. Roll the Chrysler down.
That was before we had made any terrible mistakes.
It's very Texas, of course.
Damn right.
But there is just so much wrapped up in the line, that was before we had made some terrible mistakes.
Yeah. I was thinking about that song not that long ago. Again, because I was with my old friends and, you know, kind of made references to some of the hijinks that we got into growing up, you know, stealing our mom's cars and getting drunk underage. And, you know, there's always a cutter in the friend group. So at least my friends. I was thinking about that song and you know, I meant it in the kind of sweet, in all of this kind of sweet ways that, you know, you grow up and you make mistakes and you learn things. But I was thinking about it and I was like, you know, none of us have like murdered anybody. Like the song kind of made it sound like, you know, that was before, you know, you started that international drug cartel.
I didn't
and
read
you
it that
started
way.
The opioid crisis in America, and you know, you did a hit and run on that kindergarten class. You know, it's like we didn't do anything that bad. We just learned and we grew up and we broke people's hearts or got our hearts broken or that kind of thing. It's not luckily not so dire.
Annie Clark, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me, and please edit out anything horrifying that I said.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast and learn about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Sirens drank so much that night. Caught the state of Texas in our form.